How many people know about the Croydon budget battle? Okay. Some don't. Okay, good to know. So for those of you, this is going to be fun. It's the pavilion. Yay. All right. For those of you who have only read about the Croydon budget battle in the mainstream media, today you're going to hear a story that you wouldn't have read anywhere except you would have heard some of it in the NBC documentary. Yes, you get props for that, because that was a good deal. A book has been published. Ian has written a book about it. So Ian and I did a talk at Liberty Forum about this Croydon budget battle back in whenever it was, February or March this year. And it was still really too big, because it's a long story. So we basically decided that Ian is going to give the talk, and Ian wrote the book, and it's all from his perspective, because really, it was his brainchild, right? I just had to clean up the mess, which he'll talk about. So the book contains a lot more detail than this talk is going to give. It's still a long talk. Maybe there will be some time for questions at the end. But what we're going to do after this at 3 o'clock is go to Firesteel right here at the end of this path and finish Q&A. I'll have books there that you can buy, the Croydon budget battle, and Ian can sign them. But most importantly, what we want to do is talk about how you can learn from our mistakes and do something similar, perhaps, I mean, maybe not, you know, a different thing, but something in your small town using the general idea of the power that we do have as residents. So I'm Jody Underwood. For those of you who don't know, I should have introduced myself first, but now I'm going to introduce Ian Underwood. And yeah, there we go.
Thank you. So one of the things, just as a almost author's note, when I talk about, Jody was the chair of the school board while all this was going on, so when I say the school board thought this, the school board thought that, that's mostly from conversations with her. Did everybody get through the metal detectors okay? No problems? Okay, awesome. So it's really very difficult to understand what happened. What happened to our... We're not projecting. That's okay, because I'm mostly going to read while she does this. This all started with a pamphlet that got handed out, and it's almost impossible to understand anything that happened and to really understand the depth to which things were ignored if you don't know what's in the pamphlet. So this is the thing that I handed out at the meeting. I just left it on the table. People came in and picked it up. So I'm just going to read it to you. It's short, like everything I write. It'll take a couple of minutes. So, budget or ransom? What we're being asked to vote on today isn't a budget. You all know how a budget works. You're given some amount of money to work with, your salary, your pension, and you find a way to live within those limits. What we're being asked to vote on is a ransom. You also know how a ransom works. You're told that if you don't pay some amount that's being demanded, someone or something will be taken from you. I propose that we amend the amount in Article 2, and this is the warrant article that funded the school, to reflect a budget, that is, the amount that the voters in the district want to pay rather than a ransom, that is, the amount the district officials feel like demanding. So what would a reasonable amount be? To answer that, it helps to have some historical perspective. So I think everybody has seen, has anybody not seen this graph before? This is a famous Cato graph showing how spending adjusted for inflation has tripled while achievement hasn't changed at all. So this graph confirms, and that was in the pamphlet. So this graph confirms what many people suspect, that there's no correlation between what we spend on education and the results we get. These are the government's own numbers adjusted for inflation. Over a period of half a century, we've more than tripled spending with no increases in student achievement, as measured using the test designed by the people who claim to be the experts in how to educate children. We could triple it again, and we'd have no reason to expect things to get better. Similarly, we could cut it to a third of what it is now, and we'd have no reason to expect it to get worse. We all know that money can't buy love. It turns out it can't buy education either. So here's a second graph, and this is basically across the bottom you have the amount that each state in America is spending, and you have their test scores on one of the NAEP tests. So here's a graph of what each state spends on average per student plotted against those same scores. There are a couple of things to notice. First, no state is getting the equivalent of a passing score. Second, all states are getting pretty much the same score, regardless of what they spend. States that spend $7,000 per student get the same results as states that spend three times as much. In a very real sense, it doesn't matter what we choose to spend. So here's another graph. On top, you see post-Claremont spending, and underneath, you see pre-Claremont spending, and this is adjusted for inflation. So these are directly comparable. Adjusted for inflation, all districts are now spending more than the richest districts were spending before the Claremont decisions, about $10,000 more per student on average. In terms of spending, every district is a rich district, and it hasn't made any difference at all. So how do we choose a number? Here are some numbers for comparison. The legislature has said that the cost of an adequate education is less than $4,000 per student. The state gives each charter school less than $8,000 for each student. Newport Montessori and Mount Royal, which are two very, very well-regarded private schools in the area, charge less than $9,000 per student, and the latter, at least, gives substantial discounts for additional students from the same family. VLACS charges nothing. So $10,000 per student seems like it should be more than enough to educate a child, doesn't it? We currently have a little less than 80 students. If we round up to 80 to be ready in case children move into town, a figure of $10,000 per student gives us a budget, not a ransom, of $800,000. Therefore, I propose that we amend Article 2 in the district warrant by changing the amount from $1.7 million to $800,000. There are a lot of fundamental questions that never get serious consideration under the ransom-based model of school funding. One such question is, why are we doing this in the first place? The state Supreme Court in the Claremont decision stated it's the responsibility of the state to provide each educable child with an opportunity to acquire the knowledge and learning necessary to participate intelligently in the American political, economic, and social systems of a free government. Leaving aside the question of whether the state has any responsibility towards children who are not educable, and the observation that any child with a computer and an internet connection has the opportunity to learn practically anything that there is to learn, we can ask what it means to take the word necessary seriously in this context. The simplest, most, I'm gonna, you can see that. The simplest, most straightforward way to do that is to admit that if some knowledge and learning are not required by everyone, then the state has no responsibility to pay for anyone to learn them. Can you participate intelligently in the political, economic, and social systems of a free government if you can't read, write, understand statistics, follow and construct a logical argument, and recognize a specious one? No, you can't. So learning to do these things is necessary, and taxes may be used to pay for students to learn it. Can you participate intelligently in the political, economic, and social systems of a free government if you can't speak a foreign language, play a sport or a musical instrument, calculate a derivative, weld two pieces of metal together, or set up a spreadsheet? Yes, you can. So learning to do these things is not necessary, and using taxes to pay for students to learn them crosses the boundary between public benefit and private charity. Or to put that another way, unless everyone needs to learn something, no one can be compelled to pay for students to learn it. Here are some other questions that need to be considered. If a kid wants to learn something, can anyone stop him? If a kid doesn't want to learn something, can anyone make him? What's the difference in cost between, one, teaching kids to read and then letting them learn specific course content by reading, and, two, paying teachers to read that content to students who can't read it? Does it make sense for poorer people to pay to educate the children of richer people? These are all questions that can be safely ignored as long as districts are funded using ransoms instead of budgets. Will it be difficult for our school board to find a way to get by with $10,000 per student? Only if it tries to keep taking the same failed approach. The point of putting them on a budget is to force them to find ways to use an entirely reasonable amount of money to accomplish what, not what parents would like, but what all of us need. So that was what people picked up. They picked it up, sat in their chairs, and read this, right? And these were not people who showed up thinking that anything like this was going to happen. These are the same people who show up every year, year after year. So the point I want to make from that is, this was always, from the very beginning, about getting more by spending less. More education for the kids, and more control for the farm animals. I mean, the resources. I mean the taxpayers. The only way to do that is to make it impossible to keep doing business as usual. And that's something that you can do in a small town. Everything is funded by warrant articles. Anybody can change any amount in any warrant article. You can't change the purpose, but you can change the amount to anything. All you have to do is show up, make a motion, get a second, and let the discussion begin. So we'll go on to the story. If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied up before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap. But I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth, so I'm going to jump to 2018. So in 2018, I was invited to come to talk to the House Education Committee, and I ended up making a presentation to them called School Fundings in Two Jokes and Three Graphs. You can see this presentation and read it at Granite Rock. In 2019, I was invited to a gathering at Northwood to give a larger talk on the same subject, which turned into the book, Rethinking Fairness in Education. In 2020, I actually published an article at Granite Rock saying, you know what, as Confucius says, the first step towards wisdom is to call things by their right names, and I believe that school boards going forward should always refer to what they're doing as ransoms rather than budgets, because it would be more honest and it would lead to a better conversation. In 2021, the year before all this blew up, at the end of our annual meeting, I stood up and said that same thing. I said, you know what, you guys keep calling this a budget. It's really a ransom. It would be more honest if you just used the right word for it. And our town clerk thought that was amusing enough that she wrote it down in the minutes to the meeting. It's there. Anybody can check it out. And then at the annual district meeting, here's a pamphlet. And the reason I bring this up is just because part of the narrative that ended up here was that this was something that was just made up on the fly, some number was picked out of the air, and this was some coordinated effort by the Free State Project to destroy education. And in fact, it's not. Anybody who says that is being either lazy or dishonest, because there is a huge track record of me saying we don't need to get rid of schools, we need to fix them. We need to stop doing all the things that are actually interfering with education. So anyways, we move ahead to the absolutely typical meeting, right? It was reported, it was a small meeting, there was snow. In fact, again, you can go back and check the records. You can find out that there were 2 inches of snow, which is practically nothing in New Hampshire. There was an absolutely, it's always between 30 and 40 people. We had about 35, absolutely average. There were, if you actually check the registration records of who checked into the thing, there were 3 Free Staters in the room, me, her, and one other person who shall remain nameless. The only thing that was different every year than any other year was there was a pamphlet for people to read, and people picked it up and read it, apparently, while the meeting was waiting to get started. So, as always, you have this presentation. Jody in this year gave it, you know, the school board shows you this is what you're going to give us, and this is what we're going to blow it on. And they go through it line by line, and you have chances to, the people who are there have a chance to pretend that they can exercise some control, although they really can't. And then the presentation ends, and you have a vote, and everybody goes home, and that's how it normally happens. This year, a couple of things happened that I think kind of set the mood for what came later. The first was, it turns out that the superintendent in Croydon, if you look at his hourly rate, is one of the highest paid superintendents in the state of New Hampshire, which is a little bit ridiculous. But people wanted to know, how much is he actually getting paid? And it turns out his duties were divided between 3 different roles, and some had benefits and some didn't. And so they were having trouble just giving a number. And finally, somebody just said, look, can you just tell us what you pay the guy? And the business administrator was like, actually, no, we can't. We'll have to get back to you on that. So I think that set the tone for what happened. And the second thing that happened, which really tickled me, was a woman sitting to my right, who is an old timer from town, her husband was on the select board like forever, I think since Hoover was head of the FBI. Anyways, somebody I know to say hello to, no connection with her, definitely not a Free Stater. She held up her pamphlet in the middle of Jody's presentation, said, I don't even know why you're talking about this stuff. Today we're having a budget, not a ransom. And I was like, sweet. So anyways, the presentation ends, and I stand up, and I basically say what's in the first half of that pamphlet leading up to, I propose that we change this. And there's a pretty heated discussion. What? Right, somebody seconded it, and so we're off to the races. We have a discussion. Eventually somebody calls the question, says, look, let's just vote on it. And the vote was 24 to 11 to say, let's amend the article. Now, it's not passed yet, so there's more discussion. This is a two-stage process. And during this part, Jody actually got up and made a statement, which was effectively, you know what, we've been trying to keep costs down. Every time we try it, it goes in the other direction. We've raised prices, we've raised costs 30% over the last three budgets. We try to improve quality. Nothing ever seems to change. Maybe this is an opportunity. Maybe this will force us to step back, think outside the box, and make some changes. Which is true. It's a good sentiment. But in retrospect, probably a bad idea because it opened her personally and the board by association to charges that the school board orchestrated this. And so for much of the ensuing conversation, the school board was getting blamed. Oh, the Croydon school board cut their budget and they tried to do this and this. They were just handed a budget. And they just had to make the best of it, right? So after some more discussion, somebody calls the question 20 to 14. It passed. And so, again, something interesting here. Jody didn't vote either time. And there were three Free Staters in the room. All the Free Staters get up and walk out, exact same result, right? This was not, this had nothing to do with the Free State Project. This is me being a pain in the ass. And so my lesson that I took away from this later was I look back, and I hear a lot about the Overton window and how you shouldn't try to push ideas because people aren't ready for them. I guarantee you, nobody walked into that room thinking that this was going to happen or that it was even possible, but they read a really solid, logical argument backed up by data, and they thought, huh, maybe we should be less afraid of something that might work and more afraid of something we know from 50 years of experience and common sense can't work. And just like that, Bud Croydon had a budget and not a ransom, which is awesome. So that's good news for the taxpayers, right? It's good news for the students. The taxpayers got a better deal than anybody actually anticipated because it turns out the way that schools are funded, there's a big chunk that comes from the federal government and the state. And so even though we cut that pie down the middle and threw away that half, what we were left with was only 10% of the total that we needed to collect. So our taxes didn't go down by 50%, they went down by 90%. So if you were paying $3,000 a year in school taxes, you were suddenly paying $300 a year in school taxes. Which is funny because people are like, oh, my house values are gonna go down. Like people don't wanna live in a town where you're paying $300 for school taxes. The mind reels. And it was good news for students because they'd been getting a crappy education for 50 years and they were actually going to get a chance at something different. Who it wasn't good news for, I mean, apart from parents who wanted daycare, was the school board because now they had been able to just coast along every year and say, you know what, they'll tell us what they want, we'll just support it, they'll do this thing, and we just sort of sit back and watch. And now they actually had to do something, right? And the good news is they were actually up to it. So they needed to meet very quickly, I mean, like, as soon as possible. And this is where a pattern emerged, where our superintendent basically started trying to throw roadblocks in their way. And the first roadblock was, he said, well, I'm out of town, and you guys can't have a meeting without the superintendent there to chair it. And it took him a while. They had to look it up and find out he's totally just made that up, and it doesn't even make sense on his face because you are not required to have a superintendent. So it's sort of like saying you can't have a meeting without a unicorn, right? It might not be there. So there's a lesson here that I want people to take away, and that is, in regards to everything, but especially education, if anybody ever quotes you and says, this is the law, this is the rules, tell them RSA or it didn't happen. Show me the RSA, because there's a really good chance there isn't one, and second, if there is one, there's a really good chance that they're misreading it, okay? One of the ones that came up during all this was, people were looking at something that placed a requirement on parents and somehow thought it placed a requirement on a school board. But until you actually bring this stuff up, nobody knows. So they finally get around to the first meeting, and the superintendent, who routinely refers to himself, almost in the third person, as a big idea guy. I'm a big idea guy. The first thing out of his mouth, more or less, was, I just can't imagine how to do this. Which is actually him saying, I don't know how to do my job, because his job is actually to take a budget, turn it into a plan of action. And symbolically, he went and started sitting with the audience. He used to sit up at the front table. You know, we're all part of this together, and now he's in opposition to them, which could have been in opposition to them. It could have been something he's expressing solidarity with. The parents were upset. I personally think he was anticipating gunfire and wanted to be out of the way. So the board is supposed to oversee the work of actually implementing the budget. They're not supposed to do it. It's like, you know, if Intel, the people who ran Intel, turned to the board of Intel and said, you guys design the next set of chips. That's not what they're for. That's not what they're doing. So they ended up having to pay a superintendent who was then throwing obstacles in front of them, which is just, you know, in retrospect, they should have just, the very first meeting, they should say, well, you're excused. We accept your resignation. We'll find somebody who can do this job. So the first meeting comes. People are pissed, okay, mostly parents. Some people were actually okay with it, and they came to express their support, but after all the tantrums, they just left and never came back. So the school board's idea was, you know what? This first meeting, we're not even going to do anything. We're just going to let people vent, let off steam. They'll get it off their chest. Then we can get down to work. And the problem was that never ended. At every meeting, they would come back and just start bitching and bitching and bitching, and the board could never get anything done. They even set up rules saying, look, we're going to have two sessions in each meeting, and you can talk during those. But invariably, they'd be talking about something, and somebody would raise their hand and say, I didn't hear that, or could you clarify this? Did you say A or B? I'm not sure. And once anybody talked, everybody figured they could talk, and it would just disappear, okay? So the thing is, these guys are trying to think outside the box, okay? And they are surrounded by people feverishly trying to push them back into that box. And so this is a problem. And here's how it manifests itself. This is just one of many possible examples that I could give. But at one point, they had a few minutes where people weren't complaining. They thought, you know, we have this tuitioning program. We only have our school through fourth grade, and then we pay to send kids to other schools. What if we went to those other schools and, you know, their marginal cost of accepting a kid from Croydon is zero. We send a kid from Croydon to Sunapee, nothing changes. They don't spend any more money. They don't hire any teachers. They don't run any buses. They don't give them any meals. Nothing. It costs them nothing. So if we give them $9,000 instead of $15,000, they're still way ahead, right? So this is what they were talking about. That night, one of the parents from the audience went home and started calling all the schools in the area saying, you're not really going to let Croydon offer you less money, are you? I mean, just totally undercutting them at every turn. And so this turned out to be a problem because there's only three people on the Croydon board, which means if any two of them get together to talk about something, that's a quorum, that's a public meeting, it has to be posted, you have to wait till the appointed time, and then people can come in and basically try to cut you off at the knees. So one of the lessons, if you ever want to do this in your own town, is before you do this, you might want to increase your board to at least five people so that they can meet in pairs and actually get some work done. So during all this, I kept asking this question. I had said, as you know from the pamphlet, I'm trying to get a discussion going. There's some questions that we need to talk about. And the first question, of course, is why are we doing this, right? And so, because if we don't know what it is we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it, then we can only succeed by accident. And 50 years of data and common sense show that this is just not happening and not likely to happen. So I would always start with that quote from the Supreme Court, right? This is their statement about why we're doing this. We are trying, you know, opportunity, educable, necessity, right? Necessary. And every time I would do this, it was so predictable that I would get people be shouting out things like, that's just a crazy free stater idea. That's too narrow a view of public education. That's a detriment to society. And I'm just like, I'm just quoting the Supreme Court, and they're just quoting the Constitution. So I don't know how far out of the mainstream this could be. But it got to the point where I was actually asked in an interview about this. I gave this answer, and the journalist looked at me and said, oh, you're just being an originalist. And I'm like, we're talking about a court case from 1998. Everybody's still alive, you know? So it's just, but this was, it was just a reflexive response. So at the same time, the board, mostly Jody, but also other members of the board, were trying to ask a question of their own, which is, what are your academic goals for your kids? If we can't do everything, which things should we prioritize? And the answers always came back. They want sports. They want extracurricular activities. They want daycare, although they wouldn't use the word daycare. But there was intense interest in how soon can I drop my kid off and how late can I pick him up? They were interested in transportation, not having to, you know, being able to get buses to take everywhere, and some of them wanted job training. And this is an important lesson, which I will do a talk on some other day. But it occurred to me almost too late in the process that every time they were doing this, what they were actually saying was, we don't really want a school at all. We want a community center, you know? And I think going forward, that might actually turn out to be the key to fixing education, is separating academics from everything else. You have 2 days a week, 2 hours a day for academics, which is probably about all you need, and that's funded by taxes. And then there's a community center funded by some other way. And so the answer to the problem that we're having with schools might be as simple as this. Let's make schools schools again. So in spite of all odds, they came up with a plan. And it was a good plan, right? And the plan was basically, you can tick it off in 3 points. One, they were going to use microschools as the free option for every kid. Two, they were going to move the tuition cap down to a sustainable level, which was inside the amount they'd been given. And three, they were going to make special education special again, right? So in terms of microschools, I mean, you can talk a lot about microschools, but here's sort of the thing they all have in common, right? Students should learn through individualized instruction how to take responsibility for their own learning. So over time, they become more self-reliant and less teacher-dependent. That's the common thread through everybody who tries to implement this thing, right? There are other ways that they may or may not do it. But it usually involves an online curriculum. As soon as parents heard the word online, they thought, oh no, this is going to be remote learning, even though it's practically the opposite of remote learning. So one of the things, the discussions we didn't get to have is, you know, it's sort of, could micro schools be better? That was the thing. Well, they won't be better than public schools. And it's like, okay, so in New Hampshire, we have about a 90% graduation rate, and we have about a 40% proficiency rate. And we've achieved this. We're one of the best schools for education, or best states for education. We've achieved this by insisting on certification for teachers and administrators and janitors and everybody else. And the real question is not, could this be better? The real question is, could it be any worse? And the answer is really no, but nobody would ever sort of admit that. And they just kept saying, oh, it's going to be an experiment. You want to experiment on our kids? It's like, no, I want to end the experiment we've been running for 50 years, which has conclusively demonstrated that the people who have certification have no idea what they're doing. So the second thing was, we always had a tuition cap, and the way that worked was we set it arbitrarily at the cost of Newport. So if you wanted to send a kid to Sunapee, that's less than Newport, we'd pay it. If you want to send them to Newport, we'd pay it. If you want to send them someplace like Kimball Union Academy, $30,000 a year, we'd give you $19,000, you make up the rest. So that always existed. People were like, you're going to destroy school choice. It's like, no, here's all we're saying. We're just saying, maybe it's not such a good idea to spend $19,000 to send a kid to what is literally the worst school district in the state. Maybe there's a better way to handle this, okay? And so the funding in special education, the idea was just, look, they were about $100,000 short. All the regular education was paid for, and so the idea was, you know what? So that was an underestimate. We could bump that up to $12,000 per kid and then back down to $11,000. And people are like, oh, you're going to increase taxes. And it's like, look at what you're comparing it to. We're paying $22,000 now, you know? And people just, oh, taxes will go up. It's like, well, yeah, they'll go up from this year, but they'll be way down. They're not even going to get approach what you'd be paying otherwise. Really, really difficult to get this across. So I have, there's a few stories that I think actually sort of help. If you're going to do this, to understand what and who you're up against, okay? So the first story. One of the parents, they had an informational meeting where Prenda and Kaipod came down and said, we're here to answer questions for the parents. What do you want to know about how we do things? And so some parents, they weren't really much nicer to them than they were to the school board. But at one point, one person in the audience stood up and said, you know, I think this would be perfect. This would be really good for my oldest kid. But I really don't like the way the school board's going about this, so I'm against it. It's like, how do you even wrap your head around that? So another thing that happened more than once was we would have people who would stand up and say, you know, I get you have this idea that if you teach kids to read, they can teach themselves other things. And I could see how that would work for other kids, but that would never work for my kid. And every time this happened, it just broke my heart. Because first, what would it be like to be a parent with so little faith in your own kid? And second, what would it be like to be a kid growing up with parents who have so little faith in you? I just thought that was tragic, but that's who's out there. So the third one is my favorite. We have a guy, he was on the school board. He teaches math in a public school in a different district, which is relevant. And so he, at one point during a meeting, he seemed like he thought he surprised the board by getting them to admit, oh yes, we might have to spend more money on something. He's like, excellent, I'm happy to help pay for other people's kids to be educated. And that sounds like a really nice, you know, communal sentiment until you actually do the math. And so you think, well, wait a minute, you're paying at most $3,000 a year in school taxes, but your three kids are getting $50,000 in tuition. So it's like, okay, if you go to the poor box and you put $3 in and you take $50 out, are you actually helping the poor? I don't think you are. So then you try to give them the benefit of the doubt and you say, well, maybe he means after my kids are out of school, then I'll start contributing. But if you look at the amount he would have to pay back before he's actually at a net positive, it's 250 years, okay? Math teacher isn't able to do this. The mind reels, right? There's a fourth story. I think we have time. I'm going fast, so I'll do this. And that is, there was a meeting at the Department of Education where two members of the school board went, and it was just information coming to them. They weren't doing anything. They're just there to find out about Prenda and Kaipod and what contracts had been signed and what constraints there were. So they come back, and somebody from town goes, oh, my God, two of them were at a meeting. That's a public meeting. So they didn't post it, and they've broken the law, right? So it wasn't a public meeting, and even if they had posted it, it's not like the Department of Education is just going to let the public into this thing. And Jody posted the minutes. She just said, look, if you're worried about this, I'll just post my notes and that'll be the minutes of the meeting. That should have been the end of it. But they put together a petition, a bunch of parents, and went around and got people to sign it. And, you know, it said, they've broken the law and therefore they should resign, right? And this, you'll see in a few minutes how ironic that position is. But every meeting they'd be like, well, we have 100 signatures now and we want to know when you're going to resign. And one of the guys was like, I'm not going to resign, so you could stop asking. And Jody finally quoted Marcus Aurelius, and she just said, you know, as Marcus Aurelius said, the opinion of 10,000 men is of no value if none of them know anything about the subject. And that was the end of the petition. So props to Jody for that. That was awesome. So everything's going great, and then somebody finds an RSA that exists that, I don't, as far as I know, it's never been used, okay, which says, oh, even though that is a legally binding amount from the first meeting, you can have a second meeting if you meet certain qualifications, and it's a very high bar to meet. The first thing you have to do is whatever the registration list, registered voters for the first meeting, has to be the same for the second meeting. You can make corrections of things like addresses, but you can't add anybody to it. And the second thing is, when you have the vote at that second meeting, at least half, more than half of the people on that list have to cast a vote. So for Croydon, the magic number was 283. That was one more than half of the number of registered voters. And so if, say, 150 people showed up and it was 100 to 50 in a vote, it doesn't matter because you didn't get enough people participating. So at that point, it just seemed unreachable. We had never had that level of participation in anything that had ever happened in Croydon. So I wasn't all that worried about it, but just to be safe, I thought, you know what? I'll send out a mailer at my own expense, and I sent out this postcard, which basically said, you know, you like the budget you have, you can keep it. Just stay home. Don't go to the meeting, even to vote no. And on the back side of that, I tried to address, I mean, there was so much misinformation, so many just misstatements that were all completely correctable if you just looked at public documents and the meetings. All the school board meetings were being recorded and streamed. So there were, you know, the main ones were like, oh my God, they're going to close our little red schoolhouse. No, they weren't. They said that 500 times. Oh my God, they're just going to be on screens all day. No, the whole point of a micro school is they have very limited screen time. And so, oh, they won't have certified teachers. It's like, okay, they will, but as I pointed out, maybe they shouldn't. So, you know, this was basically all I did, and I just thought, you know what, between this, nobody's going to actually vote for something that's going to double their taxes, and you know, why would you do it? So I really felt like they were never going to get that. So a group called We Stand Up for Croydon Students was formed. It's mostly referred to as Stand Up. It should have been called Hold Up. They had three huge advantages. One was money, one was media, and one is what I'll call the oral law. So the money was easy to see, right? Everywhere you look suddenly in Croydon, there are lawn signs like the ones you see in elections. People had spare trucks, apparently, that they could park all over in strategic locations with full-size signs. I think they had everything short of blimps. And they had multiple mailings. I mean, several mailings went out, mostly telling a lot of misstatements. This stuff is not inexpensive, and the NEA ran a television ad in support of them. Not directly named. I don't know if they actually appear. They might actually appear in the ad. Anyway, so there was a lot of money, and if you want to try this at home, you're going to have to be prepared for that. The second thing was media. So this actually got picked up nationally. The New York Times talked about it, Forbes talked about it, NPR, NHPR, NBC, to their credit. Too little, too late, however. And what happened when the media jumped in is the narrative changed from being grudgingly about issues. It was hard enough to get people to talk about anything, but it completely changed to personalities. Four legs good, two legs bad. That became the story. As soon as you identify, oh, this is all about Free Staters and have this they've got this concentrated, coordinated effort to do all this stuff, as soon as you've identified them as terrible people, you don't have to listen to anything they have to say, right? It's sort of like Terry Gross said this once in a thing about whites. It's like, oh, those guys are just white supremacists. We don't have to listen to them. It's like, I think your job as a journalist is to listen to them, you know, and let other people listen to them too. But that was not what was going on. The whole idea was just good guy, bad guy. They're the bad guys. Just don't pay any attention to them. So just a couple of stories which are too good to pass up. So this picture of Jody, this is awesome. So the guy from the New York Times shows up, meets her at the town hall. She was there for some reason. He's like, oh, you're Jody Underwood. Can I get a picture of you for the story we're doing? She's like, okay, fine. So they're going around and they're taking inside, outside, in this building, in front of that building, artificial light, natural light, hundreds of pictures. Hundreds, would you say hundreds? Dozens of pictures, and finally she's looking off into some direction and he snaps this picture, and this is the one they used. He went to a hell of a lot of trouble to find that picture. To her credit, she made it her Facebook, whatever you call it on Facebook, when it's your, what's it? Whatever, her profile picture. So there's another thing. So early on in this, after it started, NHPR, wanted to interview me, and I was like, great, let's talk about education. We spent 2 hours talking about education, talking about what it should cost, what it has to cost, what the point is, who should be doing what. And all of this was reduced in their story to one soundbite, which was just something I said offhand, which was more or less this. You know, if we took all the money we're spending on Newport and we piled it in the street and burned it, at least we'd get heat, which is more than we're getting now. That became the summary of what was supposed to be a substantive discussion of education, okay? So this is, again, something you just need to know. The media in general are just really, they have their narrative, they have the story they're going to tell, and they're going to tell it no matter what is going on. They were also the people who kept saying, he's trying to dismantle, Ian wants to dismantle public schools. And as I said, I got a track record of saying exactly the opposite. And yet, nobody mentioned it. Actually, there was one guy, is that you? Carol? Yeah. One guy, stand up, applaud this guy. During all this, there was exactly one story that was written by somebody who read what I had written, and it was his story. So, again, you know, didn't get. So anyways, the oral law. So I mentioned the oral law. Okay, so suddenly there is a lot of interest in people. Suddenly, oh, I want to vote. I want to vote at the special meeting. So they're showing up at the town office and saying, we want to vote. I want to vote. And the people who keep the checklist are like, great, fill out the form. We'll add you after the special meeting because that's what the law says. And they're like, well, no, I want to vote at the special meeting. Somehow stand-up got a phone call arranged, a conference call with officials from the Secretary of State and the Attorney General's office and some people from stand-up and the town clerk and the town moderator and a couple of other people who were involved in this, the people who run the checklist. They're all in this thing. It's been recorded. You could listen to it. And at the beginning of the call, they say, you know what, we're here to just tell you what the law is as it's written, not as we wish it was written. And about 15 minutes later, suddenly, the people who run the checklist are like, well, the law says we can make corrections but not additions. And they're told, oh, no, that's obsolete. You can ignore that. And they're like, what? And there's a little back and forth. And then finally, our town moderator, who is himself a lawyer, you hear him saying, I don't understand how we can just ignore a written statute. And they're just told flat out by, in fact, somebody who is now being nominated for a judgeship, it's obsolete, you can ignore it, just add the people to the list. This is the oral law. It has nothing to do with what's written down. It's whatever the people who are interpreting it for you want it to be. And that's how this works. So overnight, the list grew by 20%, all of whom were in favor of the ransom rather than the budget. And the lesson is, it's just the ends justify the means. So as I said, they were so concerned that maybe they'd broken the right to law, the right to no law. And suddenly when this law is in their way, this just bulldozed right over it. So on meeting day, I stayed home, took my own advice. Jody went. She didn't register. She just thought she should see what was going on. And mainly what she saw, and you can see this in the NBC documentary, is a lot of electioneering. I mean, people being brought in who don't actually know why they're there. People being escorted up to the voting box, being told, yeah, tear off this part and put it in without really knowing what they were voting for. They're just there, well, I got to support my neighbors because everybody's really upset about this. And so, of course, the result is 377-2, which is widely reported, and it was implied and reported at least once, I think twice, that Jody and I were the two, right? And it's the whole town against us. But of course, I wasn't there. She didn't register to vote, so it wasn't us, okay? But that's not even the worst part. The worst part is nobody mentioned the 300 people who stayed home because they got that postcard saying, if I go to the meeting, I'm cutting my own throat. So it was really 377-300 or so, right? So the rhetoric after this was all, oh, this is so wonderful how the community came together to do something we all want. And it's like, no, actually 55% of the community came together to extort nearly $1 million from 45% who didn't want to give it to them, okay? And so I got a text after the meeting from an HPR, and they said, do you have any comments on this? And I texted this back. I said, I know you're not going to write it, but I hope some journalist writes a story about the object lesson presented today for the benefit of Croydon's children. If one person uses the threat of force to take money away from one other person who doesn't want to give it to him, that's robbery, and it's bad. But if 377 people use the threat of force to take money away from 300 people who don't want to give it to him, that's democracy, and it's good. Do you have any thoughts on how you're supposed to raise moral children in a society that operates this way? And of course, I never heard back from them. So that was the end of the original story. Basically, they got the ransom. There was nothing we could do about it. But there's sort of an epilogue. A few things have happened since then. So one is, I call it the $1 million question. Budget season came up. They're having a budget hearing in Croydon, and they're talking about, here's what we're going to take from everybody, and here's how we're going to spend it on it. And they had been reporting for months how lousy the results were. I mean, you got a school with 28 kids, and I don't know, sometimes it seems like 25 teachers, but it's not really that high. But 25% of the kids are at proficiency in reading, which is just ridiculous. And they keep reporting the numbers as if it's great, we're doing great, everything's wonderful. And so I, by this time, had found out an RSA of my own that I didn't know existed, 193H2, which says all schools shall have all students at proficiency as measured by the state tests. It just says that plainly. It doesn't make any exceptions for special education kids, kids who have test anxiety, whatever. You're just supposed to have them there. So I said, okay, how much would it cost to be in compliance with that law? Because that's the amount you should be asking for, the 1.7, 1.8 million you're asking for now. We know that's not going to work. We're going to ask for the same thing. We're going to get the same thing, which is the kids can't read. What would it cost to do the job? And the guy was like, well, that's just a philosophical question. And he made some hand motions about it takes time, whatever. And he's clearly waffling. I said, okay, let me ask it another way. For $1 million per student, you'd be able to teach these kids to read, and for the $30,000 we're spending now, you can't. So somewhere in between, there's a number. There's the smallest number where you could actually get this job done. And he basically said, no, there isn't. For $1 million, we couldn't do it. And I went home, and I was just, I couldn't believe it. So I went back the next meeting, like a week, 2 weeks later, same question, same answer, right? $1 million a kid, you can't teach these kids to read. that'll become less mysterious in a moment. What I loved about this was each time I did this, I was essentially standing up saying, how much would we have to raise the budget to get kids to read? One or two or three parents would stand up right after me and say, I am so tired of these free staters who just want to cut taxes and close the schools down. Okay? This is the response. And at the annual meeting, I actually made another proposal, just like the year before. I'm like, why don't we add a bunch of money so we can hire reading specialists? And even if they have to follow the kids home, you know, and teach their parents to read, it doesn't matter. Let's add some money so that the kids actually learn to read. And the response from, you know, the leader of Standard was, I don't think we need to listen to anything Ian has to say. Let's just vote and go home. And that's what they did, right? So fast forward to 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago, Jody's at a school board meeting, and she's like, in the audience. So she comes home, and she's like, the principal said they don't know how to teach kids to read. And I'm like, yeah, sure, right. And so we looked. There's a video of it. And one of the, she's giving the same dismal results, and one of the school board members, very gingerly, so as not to hurt her feelings, sort of like, well, do you have any ideas about what to do about this? And the principal launches into about a 2-minute tap dance where she finally ends up saying, you know, there's lots of theories about how what's better for teaching kids to read, but we don't actually know which one's right. And it's like, you know, she did. She said, we don't know how to teach kids to read. So from that perspective, $1 million a year, yeah, $2 million, $10 million, $50 million, we give them all the money and the kids won't be able to read as long as these guys are in charge, right? So that was just unbelievable. So just to finish up, so we lost in Croydon, okay? That battle is lost. People there are suffering from Ian derangement syndrome. You can't say anything because it just becomes, oh, free staters, you guys are horrible. But I do believe we could win somewhere else, okay? I believe there are towns around New Hampshire where somebody could just treat Croydon as a dry run, because now that we did it, we saw all the responses, we saw where the money comes from, we saw the kinds of narratives and sad stories that would be told, we found out about the kinds of misstatements that would be made, and the next people who do it can be ready to fight this and make it happen. And all you need is to do this in one town with one budget for 1 year, and when other towns see, my God, they cut their taxes by 90%, and their reading went up 2 or 3 or 5 levels, we'll have what they're having. The whole thing comes tumbling down. It becomes unsustainable. So we're going to go over to Firesteel and talk about that, and I hope you'll join us, how to make that happen. So we still have 10 minutes, so if you have questions, I'm happy to take them.
First of all, kudos.
Thank you. Yeah. We lost.
So I love how you're taking this to, hey, you know, you can take this and use it somewhere else and take action. You know, use it to your advantage and our advantage. But how would you do it differently if you did this all over again?
Oh, man. I mean, I've thought about this a lot. The first thing I would do is I would not have a free stater introduce the motion. If I could go back in time and change one thing, I would have found an old-timer from Croydon who had... could not be branded an outsider or a radical of any kind, and there are plenty of them who would just think, we need to close these schools. These are ridiculous. Sat down with them, walked them through it, and said, you make the motion. That's the first thing I would do. Now, there are people like Jeremy Kaufman who would say, well, no, we shouldn't run away from who we are, and there's something to be said for that. But if you're trying to cut down the what can get thrown at you, that's the first thing I would do. The second thing, really, we did not realize, you need to have a narrative ready, and you need to have a plan. And that's why it's great that they came up with a plan. Another town could just use that, because one of the big criticisms was, you don't even know what you're going to do. You have no plan. It's like, well, now they have a plan, and we could implement this plan next year or 5 years from now if you feel like doing it. Any town could do this. They could set up micro schools. They could set up tuition caps. They could treat special ed as a special thing, and they could get this done. So those are two of the things I would change. The third thing then would be this whole narrative idea. What got lost in all of this? And you heard the pamphlet. This was about education. Everything was turned around to say, they're just trying to cut things and destroy the schools. And here are the sad stories. Oh, this kid isn't going to graduate with this class, which is somewhat sad. And so I would advise somebody else to have their sad stories lined up in a way that you can use the sad story to communicate the logic and the data that they also need to hear. So that's what I would do differently. Whoops. Yes.
I appreciate your effort following Confucius, calling things by the proper name, right? Calling it a ransom. In reality, that's a lot closer to the relationship of what's happening. In your experience now going forward, if someone were to do this to try to influence their school board in their town, would you recommend they use that same rhetoric?
I'm not sure.
It's tactical, right?
I go back and forth on this, and it's the kind of thing I would love to have a discussion about. I actually think there's a certain amount of shock value, and it got, I think, so here's the thing. The people at that meeting who had not then been exposed to all the misstatements and all the lies about what's going to happen to the property values, they were not shocked by it at all, right? They looked at it, and they just said, I know what a ransom is, and I know what a budget. So in that sense, it is very clear. I would be hard-pressed to move away from it. Somebody might be able to talk me into doing that, but I think it does have the value of making you stop and go, just that one thing, budget or ransom. You don't even have to read the rest of the pamphlet to just go, oh yeah, those are different. Which one would I rather have? So I see both sides of that. My inclination now would be to stick with the word, because I think it does have some value. It's a very precise description. Give us the money or we'll take your house. That's a ransom, you know? Anybody else? No? Oh.
Thank you for your talk. It was great. My question would be how to deal with the media, because I know in my town, and I know a lot of other towns, there may only be one source, may only be two local sources. At least in my town, the one source that there is, there was actually two, are very on the other side of things. So, because it's the same thing, when we try to talk about fiscal responsibility, it's you want to cut this, you want to cut that, you hate the kids. Mm-hmm. So how to deal with the media and how to sort of combat lies that are put out?
I mean, so one of the things that you might do is find people like Dan and Shira who are actually willing to at least listen to what's being said and report both sides. It doesn't have to be something for you. So I think if you can find those people ahead of time, that would put you way ahead of the game to actually identify sympathetic journalists who would actually be willing to do that. I think that's one part of it. But the other part, I think, is in some sense you need to work around them. And one of the things to go back to a previous question that I wish I had done was after sending that mailer out, having seen and heard how many people were being really just taken in by the weirdest, flimsiest logic, I would have held some public meetings and just said, look, come to the meeting, we'll talk about your fears about your house values, about taxes, and we'll also have a meeting and talk about education, why we're doing this. So I don't know that, I don't know that you can control the media. And my experience was really at this point, I got to the point where I would only really communicate in general with interviews in writing, just because that was an easier way to control it.
Yeah, so you still can't control what they're doing, though. I mean, so the narrative thing, I think, is important. I mean, even, so we were kind of accused, and rightfully so, of being on the defensive a lot rather than on the offensive with our narrative. And just like politicians, when they ask you a question that's trying to pinhole you in this negative area, like, didn't you get a lot out of public schools? Pivot to your narrative. And don't get caught in there. It takes practice. But again, yeah, with the media, they're going to report what they want to report.
Yeah, I think you can just try to be, like anything else, the more you practice, the better you get at it, the better you get at it saying, okay, I'm going to answer the question I want to answer, which when politicians do it, it drives you crazy, but you can sort of get an appreciation for why they do it, because what else are you supposed to do?
Yeah, real quick, I put together some warrant articles in my town over in Lincoln. One was to put a tax cap on it. Another one was to fire the superintendent. And those both had a lot of traction, and it raised the level of awareness. Of course, they all got tabled when all the teachers and their spouses showed up. But one thing that was upset me recently, when the superintendent put out their annual report, they because just not get too in the weeds, but there's four levels for a student's grade, And the levels 1 and 2 are failing. And they only published levels 2 and 3, and they left out the 78% of failing people in science. So, I mean, they obviously aren't teaching science whatsoever in the school. And I just didn't know why the superintendent had to put out this report. Is there something in the RSA, I don't know if you know that, that they had to? Because I don't think she would have put that out unless there was some requirement for it.
As far as I know, there aren't any. They can say whatever they want. But there is this thing called the Freedom of Information Act, right? And you can say, I want to see the numbers. Show me the numbers. And then you can publish the numbers. You can put them up on a website. You can stick them, you know, put them up in posters, staple them to telephone poles in your town and just say, this is what we're getting for our $2 or $5 or $10 million. Right. Are we happy with this? So again, if the information is there, they are going to, everybody is going to tell you the story that they think makes them look best, including me right here. So the most you can do, but you do have these laws. You do have, they have to tell you. If you ask them a question and it's not a question that they have to do a lot of work to assemble an answer to, they have to tell you the answer. So if you know the documents to look for, and this would be the kind of thing where it would be great to have people coordinating this and say, ask for this document number, ask for this document number, because it takes a lot of trial and error to figure that out. But yeah, the information's there, and if the information's there, you can get it.
That's a great response. I'll do that. And then one quick follow-up question. I asked the superintendent.
Yep, we got to go. Yeah, so we're going to Firesteel, and we're going to continue the conversation and see what we can do about this. Thank you so much for coming.